Batter Up.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 151 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-hosts, Linda Sarovich. Hello, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
It has been a while since we've had Maggie on the show. She took a short hiatus, but she is back.
And better than ever.
So we have all three of us together for the first time in quite some time.
The whole crew.
The whole gang is here.
Quorum, so we can vote on all procedural matters.
Yes. Anything in any procedural matters to vote on, send them our way. You have a short window.
The Mets win the World Series this year.
Yeah, really.
I'm putting that out.
So our first order of business before we get to more sort of recent Mets news is we because we've had guests the past couple of podcasts, which were fantastic, and we had a great time. We never actually really talked about the Carlos Correa saga in depth.
I did not agree to come back knowing that I would have to dig up my trauma again. I wasn't ready for it on an emotional level, but fine.
We have to.
So, and I mean, there has been like more developments on it since sort of the immediate aftermath happened. I did do like an Amazing Avenue Newswire with Brian and Lucas and Thomas right after the deal officially fell through with the Mets and he signed with the Twins. Like our immediate reactions to it. Obviously, it's been a couple weeks since that happened. But in that time, we did get like little nuggets of information. We learned from interviews with Correa and Scott Boras that the Mets used the same doctor for Correa's physical that the Giants used. So that was like a really special nugget of information that we learned. And in the Boras interview, Scott Boras said, quote, "I don't understand the Mets," which I think is,
I will say, though, like if the Twins doctor was saying something all that much different, they probably still wouldn't have like cut, you know, 35% off of his price tag. Like,
sure.
It's not like there was no there at all.
Right.
But it is odd that they wouldn't, especially because like things were getting kind of awkward and dramatic for a while there. It would have been nice to have used that time to find another doctor.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying that the Mets like didn't talk to any other doctors. They may have. And like, I think it even said in one of the articles that they did consult with other doctors, but they were all doctors who consulted with this one doctor who, like, I know how doctors work. Like, there are specialists in things. This is probably the ankle guy and probably one of the best ankle guys. And so everybody's going to talk to the ankle guy. I understand that, but it's kind of like, it kind of just hammers the point home of like, if you were concerned about this, why'd you get involved in the first place, knowing that this was an issue? I don't think anybody disagrees that there is some issue, that there is an issue that may be a problem down the line. And that is the reason why his deal was ultimately for way less than what the Giants and Mets original offers were. But you knew this going in. So why'd you get involved if you were going to be freaked out by the same exact doctor's report that the Giants were freaked out by, is my question.
God, I want to see that ankle. It's right? Just got to be the gnarliest thing on the planet.
I guess so. I don't know. Like, it's
stuff growing out of it.
It's frustrating because, and I guess this kind of transitions to Elise, our lovely artist friend Elise sent us an email, and I want to read the email because it articulates a lot of things that I kind of feel about this. And so Elise says, "Hi, Allison, Maggie, and Linda. I hope you can address the Carlos Correa debacle in light of the Nightingale article's Boras quotes, of which I read one of them in part. I don't understand the Mets. After I read the article, I was quite angry. As a fan, I felt duped by Cohen. My thinking is that he and the front office discussed the cons of bringing in Correa specifically as it concerns money. I do not believe the ankle plate has had as much to do with it as Andy Martino and others emphasize. It was the money and the expectations that Mets fans would have going forward about how Cohen would spend in the future that influenced the decision. Often I've heard Mets podcasters say Mets fans can't have nice things. This is an example of that. You may say that I sound spoiled, but we do have the richest owner in baseball who's being compared to Steinbrenner. Cohen is no Steinbrenner, as Yankees fans have reminded us. Cohen's about face on Correa is not just embarrassing for the Mets fans and the organization. It's a purely business decision solely to save money, ignoring the fans' desires, which were stirred up by an overeager fan in Cohen, who is overtaken by the real cynical businessman Cohen. Of course, no man as rich as Cohen is going to admit he made a mistake. We know from the lawsuits he faces that he verbally demolishes those in his employ who make mistakes. We as fans should be wary of Uncle Steve, in quotes, going forward. It really is all about the Benjamins for him. We're just fortunate that he has way more of them than the Wilpons.
Go ahead, Maggie. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I mean, first say, like, I recently found out someone I know has met Steve Cohen and finds him an absolutely terrifying human being, which is not surprising. And I think we should all remember that, like, not like he's the good one. They're all terrible. But, you know, part of what I don't totally buy is that that it's all about money, because if it was really about making money, then Steve Cohen wouldn't have bought the Mets anyway. He would have bought another index fund or whatever. I don't know what money is. He doesn't seem to be operating it like a money-making machine. I don't know. I mean, he just doesn't seem like to be the kind of guy who would be like, oh no, now everybody thinks I'm going to spend a lot of money. Like, he doesn't care what we think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't, There's things in Elise's email that I agree with wholeheartedly. I think the part where she says, like, for, I don't think it's about money as much as she thinks it's about money. But when she says the overeager fan Cohen was overtaken by the real cynical businessman Cohen, I cannot say if the cynical businessman is the quote real Cohen and the fan is not necessarily, but I do think that shift in mindset did occur. I think that he went into this Correa thing in like a fan mindset, which is good, because like that's one of the nice things about Cohen compared to previous owners and other owners in baseball, is that he is actually a fan of the team, which differentiates him from some others. I think he went into this kind of with a fan mindset. Like he said it himself, Correa takes us over the top. And he was not wrong about that at the time. And I think that he went into this like really excited and like, oh, we're pumped up. And then I am not sure if he sort of came around to like ultimately backing away on his own, or if the front office got involved there. Like, I don't have any insider information here, so this is my own speculation. Like, please do not put in the newspaper that I like said that Sandy Alderson like screwed up the Correa deal or whatever. But I think there is some reading between the lines that we can do here based on what Andy Martino was tweeting at in the immediate aftermath of all of this, when he was tweeting things like the front office was not consulted and all of this stuff. It heavily implies that Cohen acted on his own, independent of the front office, except for maybe Billy Epler, unclear. But like, he was clearly the one himself closing this Correa deal. And then maybe some more cautious elements of the front office. And I can deduce on my own who those cautious elements are, may have influenced him in the other direction. But he's Steve Cohen. He can overrule those elements if he wants to, and he chose not to.
Well, also, it seems, you know, from what we've seen of Cohen, too, is he's kind of impulsive. Like, you know, he had first with like the whole Steven Matz thing, and then he got mad and then immediately went out and signed Scherzer. than this. He saw the Correa deal falling apart with the Giants, so he kind of bullied his way in and signed Correa. So he does act like an impulsive fan. And then I guess just thinks like, oh, it is fine. Everything will work out later because I have the money to just overrule everything. I think it's his... you have to be ruthless to get to where he is. And I think maybe that's what we also see as impulsiveness is also ruthlessness, how he kind of wants to like bully all the other teams into getting the Mets all the good free agents. But then baseball isn't run that way. And it probably will never be run that way because of all the dollars for war people within the game right now. And so I think their voices are the stronger ones now, not only in the organization, but around baseball. And I think he was probably talked out of it.
Yeah. I mean, Elise says that Cohen's no Steinbrenner, but the way he acted impulsively is very much a Steinbrenner move, actually. The whole, like, I'm going to do whatever I want. And he was ultimately talked down from it, but like the owner kind of acting and like overruling the front office and acting independently of the front office is very much a Steinbrenner move, for good or for bad. I think it's certainly a double-edged sword, I think, to have an owner that operates this way. It is much preferable to have this situation than to have the Wilpons or, you know, a guy that doesn't have as much money as Steve Cohen has as your owner, for sure. But there are pitfalls of it too, because it like these guys are going to be meddlesome in their own way.
Well, no, in his own words, he said, we need another bat. And so you go from Carlos Correa to Tommy Pham. Like you've had a good offseason, but now they're like, you can't help but like recency bias.
You're I'm still holding out hope. There's got to be a trade or something. Jeepers. It cannot end with Tommy Pham.
I think it is really going to end with Tommy Pham.
I think so, too.
I mean, you never know. You never know. But I guess that does kind of transition into the other bit, one of the other bits of Mets news, which is that the Mets did sign Tommy Pham to a 1-year $6 million deal to be the fourth outfielder. Obviously, you know, one of the issues, and I talked about this and Thomas talked about this on the Newswire when we reacted immediately to the Correa situation, is that what Linda just said, it's a huge letdown. There, like after Correa, there weren't a lot of meaningful ways to upgrade the team now. Like you dangled this shiny carrot in front of us and now you've taken it away. And I can't like forget that the carrot ever existed. Like if the Mets had never gone in on Correa in the first place, I'd be happy as a clam right now. And I'm still pretty happy. You know, the Mets are a very good baseball team. I'm very excited. I don't want to make it seem like I'm just like complaining and like, and you know, being a huge downer, because I think the 2023 Mets are going to be really good and really fun to watch. But it's just like, you can't like, I can't unknow that Carlos Correa was almost on the Mets. Like I can't just like erase that information from my mind. And Tommy Pham does feel like no offense to Tommy Pham, but it does feel like a letdown in comparison.
I think even Tommy Pham knows he's not Carlos Correa. I would hope so, at least.
And I mean, you know, like this was not the replacement for Correa. Like if they had signed Correa, they might have still signed Tommy Pham. They needed a fourth outfielder, and that's what this is. Yeah. I mean, the big issue here is, and this isn't the fault of the Mets, is that even Tommy Pham was probably like their third or fourth choice for this role.
Was part of the mystery, is that there were other folks besides Tommy Pham hanging out there, and the Mets didn't go for any of those guys.
They went for some of them. They went for Andrew McCutchen. They went for Andrew McCutchen very hard, actually. They tried to outbid they offered more money than the Pirates did, but Andrew McCutchen wanted to go home to Pittsburgh, and you know, hard to blame him there. And he's gonna be a starting outfielder for the Pirates, whereas the Mets,
geez, Pirates, get it together,
not offering that, or DH. I'm not sure exactly what his role is gonna be, but he's going to get more at bats on the Pirates than he would get on the Mets for certain. And I think that the Mets had interest in the likes of Adam Duvall, for example. They were mentioned in connection with him. Now, I don't know. We don't know what we know about the McCutchen situation, where it was publicly reported that the Mets offered McCutchen more. We don't know if they actually made an offer to Duvall and if it was competitive with the Red Sox offer, the Red Sox who we signed with. Yeah. But what we do know is that, and we don't know what his motivation was, Duvall, in signing with the Red Sox, but what we do know, again, is that the Red Sox were going to be able to offer him more playing time than the Mets were ever going to. So I think a lot of these guys that they wanted for this role wanted more playing time than the Mets could offer. And so they ended up falling back on Tommy Pham. I mean, I'm kind of personally disappointed in this whole like crop of dudes that they were trying to get for like this fourth outfielder, maybe sometimes DH role. I wish they had gone harder on Trey Mancini, but I am biased in that regard. And I understand that Tommy Pham is a better fit in the sense that he can stand in the outfield as opposed to Trey Mancini, who probably like can't really do that at this stage of his career. It's more of a straight first base DH type, even though he has played outfield in his career.
Even I thought Brian Anderson might have been interesting to go after.
Yeah, that would have been a fun choice, because he could have played outfield and third base potentially.
But he ended up on the Brewers. But
yep, that was a good signing by the Brewers.
It was
a good signing by them. So we have Tommy Pham, who, you know, on paper is like fine. But
just don't start a fantasy league with him.
Exactly. It is worth noting that he does not have the greatest clubhouse reputation in the world.
According to Man Martino, though, it's okay if you fight people as long as it's not your teammates.
Oh, okay. Sure.
I couldn't tell if that tweet was a bit. And that's what I feel like I've been in this world maybe too long.
Yeah.
I don't mean like alive. I mean like this particular universe.
It's very hard to tell when Martino is trolling. So I don't
Never
know.
Never a great sign.
And like baiting the fans, which he often does. But like, yeah, he for those of you, for those uninitiated in Tommy Pham's antics, Pham-tics.
We'll know what the recurring segment's going to be called in the season.
We'll just call them Pham-tics. Whenever something comes up with Tommy Pham, if something comes up, we'll call it Pham-tics.
Wait, we can vote on that.
Yeah, yeah.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Yeah, opposed, motion passes.
Motion passes, Pham-tics. Now just thinking about the Canine Advantix commercial, Fantix, and now my brain is a ball of soup, so that's where I'm at. Anyway, but yeah, the Fantix that we are familiar with is that Tommy Pham is the guy who slapped Jock Peterson over the Fantasy Football League last year, notably. And like he's said some like, we're not talking about, again, I feel like I always have to give context, because on this show we talk about like really bad dudes. He's not on that level as far as we know, but he has said some like kind of out there stuff, we'll put it that way. He said some kind of like wild stuff. He seems to be kind of a character, I guess.
And not a character everybody like, not a great character, right. Not the characters that everybody likes,
right?
Like Josh Donaldson light.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, I'd call it Josh Donaldson light's a good way to describe it.
Didn't he also get into a fight in a strip club?
I think that did happen. Maybe I think he was stabbed.
Yes. Maybe? Yes.
Yeah, I think that might have happened.
I feel like that's not something your brain would just make up.
No.
That was a thing I think happened. So on
good like, luck, Buck Showalter. You're the man for the job.
Yeah, right. I mean, Buck Showalter has been known as a leader of you know, troublesome players in the past. So we'll see if Buck can like rein him in a little bit. Though he's a veteran player at this point, like I don't think he's really gonna be reined in all that much. I don't know.
Well, didn't they ban SNY because people were upset about like what Keith Hernandez was saying? Maybe Buck will ban like fantasy teams in the clubhouse.
Right. Yeah, that would probably be a good idea. No fantasy football, guys. At least not with each other. Like, you can maybe do some of your, like, do it with your buddies outside of baseball or whatever.
And not with Jock Peterson.
But yeah, so as far as the roster is concerned, this kind of leaves the position player side of things pretty much set, though there's kind of like, there's basically like one roster spot that's probably going to be like up for grabs slash competed for, because the locked in guys on the bench now are Nito, who we'll get to more in a little bit, Guillorme and Pham, which sort of leaves one more bench spot up for grabs. Now that could be Darren Ruff. Who's still on the team.
Sorry, Lynn. We were so close.
It's possible, but it is possible that it could be one of either Francisco Alvarez or Brett Beatty as well. All indicators point to, and this is kind of related to the Nito question, but all indicators kind of point to Francisco Alvarez starting in AAA this season. Because in the aftermath of, I guess I'll get into the Nito thing right now, the Mets signed Tomas Nito to a 2-year contract extension, which is good. You know, it's fine. It's like, it's not anything crazy. It's just basically $1.6 million this season and $2.1 million in 2024, which is essentially what he would make in arbitration. There's buying out his arbitration years, which is fine. But it's, to me, what it said, what it says is more about Francisco Alvarez than about Tomas Nito, incidentally enough. Like, it's interesting that the Mets' behavior, we'll put it this way, the Mets' behavior is not that of a team that thinks Francisco Alvarez is ready to be their starting catcher of the future. In the way that they have signed Omar Narvaez to a 1-year deal plus a player option, or not a team option, a player option for 2024. And they've now locked in Nito for 2023 and 2024. So it's kind of like, well, if you really think Francisco Alvarez is like knocking down the door and ready to take this spot, you're not behaving like a team that thinks that. I don't know why, but it just,
but that also, I mean, that may have more to do with the catching than anything else.
Yeah,
and
I think
it does. Mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, it's, they're in a tough spot in a lot of ways, because like, catchers are notoriously slow to develop. Catching skills are notoriously slow to develop. And, you know, I think they are in a tough spot in terms of like, his bat is obviously much more advanced. Do you run with the bat? Push the catching skills to the, you know, the catching side of things to the back burner, like, but then you potentially miss out on a lot of development time behind the plate. I don't know. I can see why putting him in that position right away may not be appealing to them.
Well, right. The other day, the SNY had an interview with Alvarez, and he said his defense has improved enough and he thinks he's going to be on the roster opening day. So I don't know if that was just him confidently talking or if somebody hinted at him that he would be on the roster, but he sounded confident that his name would be on the roster come opening day.
Yeah, it's unclear. I mean, like, even if the Mets don't think that his catching skills are ready, I think that, you know, obviously there is a role for him to play as a part-time DH, potentially, the other side of the Vogelbach platoon if Darren Ruff does not get that job. And Tommy Pham is also kind of partially filling that role, too, but it would be like Tommy Pham is like also the fourth outfielder. So, like, it is possible that Francisco Alvarez can make the team as like a part-time DH, and maybe he'll catch a little bit and sort of get mentored by Nito and Narvaez. Narvaez actually said in an interview that he's excited to mentor Alvarez, which was really cool to see. Something that like a quote that Alvarez gave a couple weeks ago that was basically like glossed over and like talked about for 5 minutes and then not spoken about again, but like actually concerns me deeply. And I wonder why we're not talking about it more, is he said that the Mets want him to work on his English. He said that. And I was like, is that true? Because if the Mets said that to you, that's kind of messed up. Like, holding you in AAA because they want your English to improve? Like,
well, for a catcher, I can kind of see it because he is communicating with the pitchers. But then you can always bring Lindor in to translate on the field.
Right. It was very odd. He like said that and then like he never said it again and no one talked about it. But it was a quote he gave. I saw it. So I don't know. I mean, if that's part of their motivation, then that's kind of odd. And maybe it is, but that'd be.
If that was their concern, then just like give him like an intensive 2-week course over the offseason and he's done. Right, like it's,
a teacher. Like,
I mean, ironically, I wonder if there was something kind of lost in translation there. Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely, that would be very disappointing.
Yeah, it would be. And like, I don't know how much of like work on your receiving, work on your skills as a catcher. Like maybe the Mets kind of threw the whole like communicating with the pitching staff in there as part of that. And I don't know if Alvarez took that to mean, oh, my English isn't good. Like it is possible that there was a miscommunication there. And I don't know. But the way Alvarez worded it was like, they want me to work on my English. And again, I don't know if that's like, if that's exactly what they said or what, but yeah, that was something that was cited. So yeah, it's possible that Alvarez will get that final spot. The way Andy Martino's reporting after the Mets extended Tomas Nito was that it didn't seem like Alvarez, it seemed like the team's plan was to keep him in AAA, but I don't think that is necessarily set in stone. That's just what Martino was reporting.
And the team has shown a willingness much more than like 3 or 4 years ago to roll with the best team out of spring training, even if that does mean, you know, pushing forward with someone they weren't quite sure was ready, or, you know, you know, buying into that a little bit, which is nice. I mean, I think it's good for Alvarez or anyone to go into spring training, like feeling that they can do this, that if that's, you know, if they show the stuff, then, you know, I don't really have much doubt that if he kills it in spring training, that he's going to be up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And so I think that this final spot is sort of going to be an open competition between like Darren Ruff, Francisco Alvarez, and Brett Beatty. Barring any other moves, obviously, if the Mets make another move, then that's different. But as things stand right now, that's kind of like the last position player spot left. And I think it's going to be one of those three guys. So we'll see what happens. I actually think that like, if I were a betting woman, which I'm not, anyone that knows me knows I am risk averse. But if I was a betting woman, I actually would put my money on Brett Beatty. If I were to make that call today, if I had to place a chip on one guy, I would put it on Brett Beatty, I think, to make the roster opening day.
Well, I have those a feeling they're going to try out Beatty in the outfield too.
Yeah, they might. They might do that. I mean, they were talking about doing that when they thought they were signing Carlos Correa to play third base. I think that there's less of an impetus for them to do that now that third base is kind of like open, not open. I mean, Eduardo Escobar is the likely starting third baseman, but I think that job is up for grabs now for Beatty. If he wants to push Escobar into like a role sharing with him, or like push Escobar into more of the part-time DH role because Beatty's playing so well. But I think getting him some outfield reps couldn't hurt, because it would allow him the flexibility. But it would be better, I think, for him developmentally to establish himself more defensively at his natural position, which he has not yet done. So
no,
we'll see. The only other bit of Mets news right now, things have kind of slowed down the offseason as a whole, as far as free agency is concerned, because all the major free agents have pretty much signed. But the arbitration, the deadline to agree to terms with arbitration players passed. The Mets agreed to terms with all of their arbitration players, with the notable exception of Jeff McNeil. I think there's like a $1.6 million difference between the Mets and Jeff McNeil at this point. So they're going to go to arbitration. There was a lot of fuss made by like the random weird like Mets rumor accounts that are all like run by teenagers, that because Jeff McNeil put on his Instagram story that he was at Citi Field. And so everybody, and like he attended the Rangers game, as Linda probably knows. With
yes, I did see him there. Yeah.
with his agent and John Franco. So everybody was like, "Oh my God, extension!" And I was like, "I don't think so, guys. I don't."
Apparently,
know.
You know, I saw one person point out he was there for like a little league like charity event. Or
yeah,
something.
He was there for a charity event. Like, come on, guys, chill out. Say, like, I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm begging everyone on Twitter to chill.
I don't know that I would be champing at the bit to go to arbitration with the reigning batting champ. Like that just seems to me like that. You could just save yourself an afternoon. Just like go ahead, like skip the paperwork and give him $1 million because he's the batting champ.
Yeah.
Just if it was me, that's what I would do.
There's nothing more like, how do I word this? There's no more sort of like obvious. I mean, I think we talked about this a while back when we were talking about like Steve Cohen spending and the Cohen tax and that quote that the random anonymous MLB executive gave that was like, oh my God, he's violating the norms and like the other owners are not going to be happy with him about this. And it's like basically about like we're not colluding t-shirt. Yeah. Has people asking a lot of questions about my shirt, but like there's no more obvious like demonstration of the system that's in place or like the gentleman's agreement among all the owners than the richest owner who has already demonstrated that he doesn't care about the Cohen tax going to arbitration with one of his best players over $1 million.
And it is like such a baseball thing. Like this isn't even one of those things where you're like, God, the Mets at it again. Like, no, this is just they all do this.
Like you would think if this was really about money, the rich owners would not do this and the poor owners would do it more often. But that's not the case at all, actually. It's like every team does this randomly sometimes. Like they just do this. And it's because like that is the way the system is designed. It's designed to like the team makes like a dollars per war calculation of what a player's worth and files and decides that that is what the player's salary is. And then the player decides independently, the player and his agent decide no. And I think in this case, I mean, I don't actually know, like a lot of people know a lot more about arbitration than I do. And someone who knows more than me, probably one of our listeners, to be perfectly honest, will point out like how often teams win versus how often the player wins. I don't actually know the proportions there, but I think in this case, the Mets are going to lose because, as Maggie mentioned, Jeff McNeil just won the batting title. I think he has a pretty good case to get paid.
Well, that's also strange because they just gave Pete like a record breaking.
Yeah, again, like,
I don't get it.
It's not about like the Mets being cheap. This isn't like the Mets specifically being cheap or like it's just this weird system. Every once in a while this happens and it's designed that way. Like it's a system that is meant to suppress salaries and it's weird. And like, I don't know a better solution. I mean, the better solution is to give teams fewer years of team control, really is the better solution. But that's not gonna happen probably. And so like arbitration is better than guys continuing to make league minimum until they're free agents. But I don't know like what we would replace it with, but it is a weird like wage suppressing system that baseball has.
And takes advantage of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the argument on the other side would be that in theory it is good for most players to have some sort of security early on in their career. So they have the opportunity to like put together saw, you know, playing time and, you know, make a good name for themselves, all that before they hit free agency. And that if arbitration wasn't there, the teams would be more likely to just sort of move on from their players, but because yeah. they're cheaper, they'll keep them. But at a certain point, like, we're talking about Jeff McNeil. Like, what would he yeah. make on the free agent market right now? Like,
yeah.
he, I mean, granted, he had a down year not that long ago, but, you know, I think, I mean, it would probably make somewhat more than whatever yeah. the, like, $7 million yes. or whatever yes. it was.
Absolutely.
He would make at least twice as much. Average annual value. At least
yeah, I would say if it was just a 1 year deal, somebody would smartly give him like $30 million.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like right there.
Right there. Jeff McNeil is actually a really hard, like a strangely hard player to project what he would make on the free market. Like if he were a free agent this offseason, what would his deal look like? It is a weird thought experiment to think about, because I think that he's a player who's come into his prime a little later in his career than a lot of other players, and his skill set is, and he's done the splashy thing, like won a batting title. That doesn't necessarily, like, these awards and things are often like give you like name recognition, even when you might not like have the skill set that would make you a lot of money ordinarily. But I would argue that McNeil, on the same token, is underrated as a player because his type of skills, he doesn't hit a lot of home runs. He just hits it where they ain't. And like his type of skill set is like really underrated, I think. It will be, he's going to be hurt by, like, I think not hurt by, but like other players are going to be lifted up by the limits on the shift. And it's going to like even the playing field more, because right now I think McNeil is one of the players like hurt least by the shift in all of baseball. Like, weirdly, because he just, his skills are all contact based, and he hits it where they ain't. That is literally his skill. And I have no idea how teams evaluate that and how, well, like, whether they think it's like repeatable.
I think the thing is, I mean, the thing that probably makes it harder for him than anything else is that he had such a terrible 2021.
Yeah.
Because I was like, did he have another down year? And no, he never had another down year. Like, his lowest OPS plus, because Baseball Reference came up first, but other than 21, was in 2020, it was 130. Was,
oh my his, gosh.
Like, lowest. Truly. I mean, it's that 1 year. And I think, honestly, if you took that away and you had a player who, with, you know, four straight seasons to start his career of 130 or more OPS plus, that player is going to get paid. But because it was recently enough and it was a terrible year, I could totally see that just kind of gumming things up. But I mean, if he has another one like his norm, because all of these other seasons, like, he doesn't have any other bad seasons. If he has another one like that, I mean, he should be knocking down his door, and they probably will be. He has positional flexibility. You know, he's good on defense too. It's not fake positional flexibility. So what was it, Daniel Vogelbach, they had him listed as an infielder, outfielder.
Field?
Excuse me. But yeah, so I McNeil is an interesting one, but I think the consistency, except for that one, is going to be what's going to eventually work out very strongly in his favor. And it'll work out strongly in his favor this time too, because he's going to win his arbitration case.
Yes. And like, speaking of his defense, it's improved massively.
It has.
Yes.
In his career. Like last year, he was like a legit plus defender at second base, as opposed to, like, he's always been fine, cromulent at second base, but he's turned into like legit a really good second baseman. And I think that part of that, like, you always want to give as much credit to that credit for that as possible to the player. And Jeff works really hard. We all know he does. And he deserves all the credit in the world for working on his defense, presumably all the time. But I think that there are other reasons why that's true. I think he has a very good double play partner in Francisco Lindor.
And a consistent double play partner. Yeah. I mean, that's I think that's part of it too, is just having the same up the middle pairing. They get comfortable with each other and it helps both of them.
And I think the Mets as a team have improved at positioning a great deal over the past couple of years in the new like Cohen era. Of analytics is starting to show through in the way that the Mets have done positioning. Like Brandon Nimmo is like a really good center fielder now. And I think that's part of like positioning is a big part of that. And I think it's helped McNeil as well. So, yeah, I mean like on the open market, like, I don't know, he'd be like, he would get like, he's a little too old to get like the Brandon Nimmo deal, for example. But like shave a couple years off the Brandon Nimmo deal and like do an option instead. And like, that's what Jeff McNeil would get, I think.
I feel like Chris Bryant could probably be a good comp to him because he also played like the infield and outfield, and McNeil's fine in the outfield too.
Yeah, he's
not
fine.
A detriment out there.
No, not at all. He's very solid in a corner, very solid corner outfielder.
So I get like, you know, Bryant probably has a little more home run skills than like,
yeah, he's a better hitter, but yeah, but just because,
but not by as big a margin as I think most people would think off the top of their heads.
Yeah,
like he is like Bryant, you know, a step above, but in the grand scheme, like they're close.
Yeah, but Chris Bryant's only 31 and right now, and hit free agency when he was what, 28.
He's a lot more injury prone though too. Yeah.
Jeff McNeil's been pretty injury prone in his career, but not lately.
I feel, didn't he have like a shoulder issue or a hamstring issue in 2021 too?
Yeah,
that does sound like, and
that might have contributed to his struggle.
And I mean, Jeff McNeil is actually younger than Chris Bryant, but like he's gonna hit free agency later than Chris Bryant.
And he did get a late start to his career. You know, he came up when he was 26. Not the 26-year-olds are old.
Or no.
But like, you know, that's, he's just a little bit later than a lot of players of a similar caliber.
Yeah. So
we probably should mention the Hall of Fame voting too, since the Mets did not get in.
Yeah, I guess. I like caring so much less and less about Hall of Fame every year, which is sad, but it's just like, I feel like I like know too much about all of this and it makes me enjoy it less, which is kind of sad.
Well, because I feel like there's this game that gets played with the voting a lot where where we all know who's going to make it in, probably. There's some borderlines, but like, and it's just, well, I'm not going to vote for that guy until I've had 3 years complaining about this, and then I'll vote for it. I mean, it's so, but we end up with these long stretches of time before any one person gets elected, where like year after year, you're like, is Scott Rolen going to get in? Is Billy Wagner going to get in? Like, and you know, by the time one of those actually does happen, and congratulations, Scott Rolen, very well deserved.
Yes.
I'm just so tired of it. Like,
yeah.
I thought he got elected like 3 years ago. Like, come on, man. I cannot maintain this line of thought for that long.
Yeah, so the Hall of Fame voting news is that Scott Rolen is the only guy on the current ballot who got in, who got the requisite 75% of votes to get in. He got 76.3% of the vote. Billy Wagner was one among those who like kind of not just missed, but below the threshold by a little bit at 68%. But you know, may get in event, like in the realm of might get in eventually. And then, notably for the podcast, sadly, among the players receiving less than 5% is R.A. Dickey. Zero. He got one vote though. I want to know if you are the person who voted for R.A. Dickey, I would like to buy you a beer.
Yeah.
Whoever you are out there, I would like to buy you a beer. Whoever
you are. Make yourself known.
Make yourself known. I feel
like there should be more, like, as long as voting is a game, which it is, and not actually about, like, these are the individuals that I believe should be in the Hall of Fame, because we know that that's not actually how people are voting. Even like, you know, people we like, still there's a certain amount of like self-expression via vote, but there should be more R.A. Dickey votes. Not yes. enough that like we need to keep this guy on the ballot for very long, but I would love to see more voters have fun with it, because they're playing games, but when they play games, they tend to be angry games. And like, no, play the fun games where you vote for R.A. Dickey because he's a mensch. Like, do that.
Because you can.
Bronson Arroyo, because he's funny as heck. Like, come on, man. There's,
you know, have some fun.
Yeah. Just Jason Worth, because you've got a weird thing for beards. Just hit me up. Sorry, I'm actually looking at the ballot right now. It's just like, but like, I don't know. I feel like if I had a ballot, I would have voted for R.A. Dickey. Not because I think he's a Hall of Famer, but because voting for the Hall of Fame is a good is a game, and because he's a good dude.
J.J. Hardy, because I always loved the way that the Orioles PA announcer said, J.J. Hardy!
that's a legitimate reason to vote, that is.
A legitimate reason.
10 times more valuable to baseball and its discourse than even a single blank ballot.
Yeah.
Yes. Serious. Well, and then because then you get all
or
these...
spending like a like, you know, 3,000 words explaining your vote for Omar Vizquel.
I was like, just gonna say that you get all these sad comms like, this was such a hard process for me, and it's like, you're now you're making it about yourself instead of a very real victim at the hands of Omar.
It's
Vizquel.
Literally like why I joined The Athletic, except it's like why I voted for Omar Vizquel. And I'm just like, I grow tired. I am tired of this. I am weary. I would rather just vote for R.A. Dickey.
A little heads up, David Wright is on the ballot next year.
Jesus Christ.
I am old. Two, that's going to start some discourse.
I'm not ready.
He's not going to make the Hall of Fame. No, it breaks my heart. But
he didn't play long enough.
But
he's
not
going to
drop off the ballot. He'll get multiple ballots.
I want him to have a good few years there where we all get to think about him.
And look at his name on the ballot. And I hope that it's at least a few years before he drops off the ballot.
I don't think he'll drop off.
I don't think he'll drop off. I think he'll always get enough to not drop off.
I hope I find the perfect moment to make a joke about him having trouble deciding what hat he would wear. Because that just feels like I can do something with that. Okay, put a pin in that. Okay, subconscious. Remember that in 3 years. We're on it.
I also figured during our baseball segment this week, given the fact that we did talk a little bit about the Correa post-mortem and, oh no, what's the point of having the richest owner in baseball if we can't have Carlos Correa? Just a perspective, it could always be worse, folks. We'll take a drive around the majors and show you how much worse it could be.
Oh boy.
I've got three stories, which is actually now kind of four, although like the third one is kind of a 3A and 3B, so we'll call it three stories about owners in a segment I'm going to call I took the form of a 45-year-old white man for a reason. I can only fail up. So story number one, Phil Castellini.
Oh God.
Y'all remember Phil Castellini, right? He's the where are you gonna go guy, the fail son of Reds owner Bob Castellini. And
why
Reds-
do they keep trying this dude out here? I mean, really?
Yeah, why is he allowed to speak to anyone? Is my question. Because he, like, Phil Castellini is, so there's kind of like there's like kind of two categories of like bad cheap owner, right? There's like the step on rakes kind, and that's Phil Castellini. And then there's the like actually like malevolent kind, because I think that Phil Castellini is just kind of a dunce and like not like he's not trying to be like evil, but he's just like, oh, what are we going to do? We're the Reds. And you're like, oh, my God. He said the quiet part out loud again. Yeah. And we'll get into the more evil kind, because I think that the John Angelos comments are like way more sinister than Phil Castellini's in a lot of ways. but Phil Castellini is more fun to make fun of. So we'll start there. He's the guy who said, "Where are you going to go?" Basically mocking the fans when people were talking about how upset they were about how the Reds were being run. And he's like, and "You should sell the team." And he's like, "Sell it to who? Where are you guys going to go?"
Which just brings to mind, of course, the meme where it's the, "What are you going to do? Stab me?" And
yeah,
it's the quote from the guy who has just been stabbed.
The guy who has just been stabbed. Yes. Yeah.
What are you going to do? Guy. Not root for my baseball team anymore?
Oh, no.
Ding, ding, ding.
So I regret to inform you all that that guy is at it again. In a presentation to a booster group, which is called Rosie Reds, which I think are like their origins is are like the people who advocated for like keeping the Reds in Cincinnati when there was a chance that they might leave Cincinnati. But it's basically turned into like a booster club for the team. It's like, you know, like people who give lots of money to the Reds. He gave a presentation to that booster group. In that presentation, he showed a slide titled "Teams Out of Contention by Opening Day." And guess who was on there? The Cincinnati Reds. Which, oops. I mean, like, number one, that's just like cravenly cynical. You're really saying that you have no chance on opening day. You don't believe in your own team, which, like, I get it. I get the sentiment of that. But he also showed, like, I think it was like, I can't remember the exact chart. I saw it, but it was like a third of teams that he showed. And I really think that he's like overestimating how many teams are truly out of it on opening day. Like, statistically, it's not actually true that there's that many teams that are out of it on opening day.
The Reds are.
Yeah, maybe the Reds are.
They are one of those teams.
But yeah, so that was like the first part of it. And then
who approved that slideshow, though?
Yeah, I don't
know. Who thought that was a good idea?
He did. and then he like basically bemoaned the Reds operating like, quote, a nonprofit organization, which let me tell you, I am sure the Cincinnati Reds make a profit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, but the worst part of it is that he like went on to talk about like some of the great prospects that the Reds have. And he was like, "Of course we're going to lose them." These are guys that have not even played in the major leagues yet, and he's already talking about how like they're not going to retain those players.
Like, way to get the team excited for the new season.
Oh my god, it's just like, so, oh god, nonprofit organization, that's like so special. Anyway, so that's story number one. Story number two, which I think is the more like Phil Castellini is the more stepping on rakes type. I think John Angelos is the more like malevolent type of cheap owner at this point. John Angelos, for those of you who don't know, he is the Orioles chairman and fail son of owner Peter Angelos. The two
There's
Angelos brothers.
Here.
What?
There's a theme here with fail sons.
Fail sons. The two Angelos brothers are currently fighting over control of the Orioles. They are like suing each other back and forth over control of the Orioles. But John Angelos, who's I think been the one who's been like more or less like operating, like being the owner right now. He did a charity event at Camden Yards on Martin Luther King Day. And a reporter tried to ask him about the future of the Orioles. And Angelos used Martin Luther King to shield himself and scold the reporter, being like, he clutched his pearls and was like, "On this day of all days, you want to ask me about the Orioles? Sir, how dare you? It's Martin Luther King Day." And I was like, oh, come on. Are you freaking kidding me? Like, it's one thing if I believed that was like genuine, but I do not.
No, absolutely not.
Like, and like, he went on to say that the reporters could come back, quote, next week, and he'd show them everything, all the Orioles books, all the financials. "You can come back any other day other than this sacred day, and I will show you everything."
Oh, please.
It's next week. Has he shown anyone anything?
No. And he's just in the middle of getting a few things reorganized, and he'll absolutely have them for you later this week, next week at the latest.
It's a top priority.
Where's this warehouse event? I want to know. I'll come. I'll drive up to Baltimore and see the Orioles books. Let me know. I'll be there. It's not that far of a drive for me. Instead, like literally today, I'm trying to find it because it happened like the news broke literally earlier today. Oh, yeah. Here it is. The latest on the Angelos family legal drama. Louis Angelos, who's the other brother, claims John and Georgia Angelos, Georgia being the matriarch, quote, systematically drained a bank account that belonged to Peter Angelos that previously held more than $65 million. So there's just more, like, all that dropped today was more news about the lawsuits and counter lawsuits. So if that's what you mean by the Orioles books, then sure.
Woof.
But yeah, so that's that. He did say the Orioles are not leaving Baltimore, though, rest assured.
That's something, I guess.
Yeah. But speaking of not selling or not leaving the city, finally, story number three, which kind of has two parts now. Part number one, we learned that Art Moreno is not selling the Angels after all. Sorry, Angels fans. Womp womp.
Shohei Ohtani, you are a New York Met.
Yeah! I think it does, like, seriously, I think it does increase the chances a little bit that
Shohei, I think so too.
Doesn't hurt.
Ends up a New York Met. We shall see.
Like, why would he want to stay when he's seen how he runs the team? Like, there's no hope there.
No. No. And it's...
He'll even pony up the dough for Ohtani.
And it seems like Moreno, like, seriously just got cold feet about the whole thing, because it was basically like the story of the Angels is that they had Moreno and co had like launched like basically an exploratory campaign into selling the team, right? Like, we are going to like put feelers out there about selling the team. And it's not that, it seems as if, based on his quotes today, it's not as if they did not have interest. It's one thing when you try to sell the team and no one wants to buy it. That's what's happening with the Nationals right now. It's one thing when you try to sell the team and no one wants to buy it. That's what's happening with the Nationals, and why the Nationals owners are trying to seek like minority owners instead of like selling the team outright.
Not as opposed to majority owners.
Yes.
Just to clarify.
Yes. Not as opposed to. Yeah. Yes. As in less
a mustachio
than
50- gentleman named Shmeev Shmutwin is interested in purchasing the Nationals, but he doesn't seem too interested in upgrading the team. Strange.
Right. As in like people that have less than 50% stake in the team, owners. But in Moreno's case, it seems as if they had interest and he had just had a change of heart, got cold feet, backed out. Like the Mets and Carlos Correa style. Like, he was just like, oh, never mind. I don't want to. So they're not doing it. And this, not the same thing, but a similar, I guess, in the same realm of like, who says we're selling the team? We're not selling the team. The Marlins owner gave a very similar quote. Well, there was a rumor that there was exploration into selling the Marlins, and the Marlins owner quickly put the kibosh on that immediately and was like, I am never selling the Marlins. And it's like, oh dear.
Yeah. I just feel bad for, like, because we got out of that bad relationship. I just feel bad for other teams. I have no hope.
Yep. At least when the Wilpons sold the Mets, they really meant it.
Yeah. Thank you, Tiki Barber.
Can you guys imagine if the Mets did if the Wilpons did this?
Twitter like, would have burned down long before today. Or
if they were like, we're gonna sell the Mets, and then they were like, just kidding, we're not gonna sell the Mets.
Oh lordy.
Oh, I think that like Mets Twitter, City Field, everything would have burned to the ground.
Yeah. Just everything raised to the ground, then just ashes. Like, even the ashes would have been thrown into the harbor.
Like, that would have been a, like, we would not have, like, a level of raising we have not seen since Sherman level. Like, that would have been bad.
Yeah.
But alas, I mean, we are so again, part of the point of this is to point out, like, wider trends and problems in baseball of, like, these ownership groups that are craven and terrible. But the other part is to reassure Mets fans that, you know, as frustrating as the Correa situation was, it could be worse.
And we know that.
We know that. Could be a lot worse. So one more unfortunate bit of baseball news that we do have to cover, that just broke today, before we recorded. We are recording this on Tuesday night, the 24th. Mike Clevinger, recently signed by the Chicago White Sox, is under investigation by Major League Baseball for allegations of domestic violence by the mother of his 10-month-old daughter, who accuses Clevinger of physical, verbal, and emotional abuse of both her and her child. So he is under investigation for domestic violence and for child abuse. I will not go into detail about the things he's accused of doing because they are really disgusting. You can go read them for yourself if you want to, but it's really messed up. And running out of new things to say. There's another day, another fucking shithead.
Well, it also spoke volumes about the company he kept too.
Yes.
So, I mean, it wasn't a shock. When
noted Trevor Bauer associate, yeah. Mike Clevinger.
Yeah.
Birds of a feather.
Yep, that's exactly it. Birds of a feather.
And his friendship with Trevor Bauer was not the only red flag here. There have been red flags about him for a long time. Stuff that he has multiple exes who have called him out for bad behavior. And they have posted on like their Instagrams or their like social media accounts about his behavior, but this is just the first time that anyone's taken it to Major League Baseball. So like he's been suspect for a while, we'll put it that way.
Wasn't he one of the ones that also like flaunted the vaccine or like the mask mandates too?
Yes, I don't recall if he...
I remember Lindor got into it with him.
Yes, he got in trouble for, like, I don't recall, like, whether he was, like, vaccinated or unvaccinated or, like, what his actual stance on the vaccine was, but I do remember that he got in trouble for, like, violating the COVID protocols. Like, he went out when he wasn't supposed to.
Yes, that was
Like, in 2020 when, like, things were, like, really locked down, he, like, went out with a teammate. It was him and a relief pitcher whose name I can't remember at the moment. They like went out and broke protocol and got disciplined for it. So that was a thing. But yeah, he's kind of has like multiple strikes against him before this for being just like kind of a known asshole. But now like this is like really, really heinous behavior that he might be suspended for. The White Sox notably claim that they did not know about this when they signed him, which I find strange. I am not accusing the White Sox of lying about this, of lying about not knowing. I just find it strange that the victim had been talking to Major League Baseball about this since the summer, and it's now winter, and the White Sox knew nothing about it. I mean, I know that the CBA, I like said it's kind of strange. And then someone pointed out, Heather pointed out to me on Twitter, Heather is an Orioles fan. She pointed out to me on Twitter that like this probably has to do with the collective bargaining agreement. Why? I know that that this played out with Bauer too, that they couldn't share the details of the investigation with the Dodgers. And that's probably true in this case as well, that they couldn't share with the team the details of the investigation because of the collective bargaining agreement. Probably has like a clause in it that says that you can't. And I understand from a players union perspective why you would want that, because like you wouldn't want any unresolved investigation to impact whether a player gets signed or his salary. But like, I don't know. you'd think a team would want to know if they were potentially employing like a terrible human being.
And apparently, like we said, a lot of this was on social media. So if they had done any research before,
exactly, like background check
on your own.
Well, yeah. Also, like if they had been working on it since the summer, then maybe that is part of the problem with investigations taking 6 months. Right. You know, in terms of like, well, maybe they should do that a little faster. And I'm not saying that you should rush it, but I have a feeling if we actually go in and look at the timeline of the effort that they have put in to investigating these claims, it would not be particularly impressive.
Yeah. So it's just
so
like
please investigate the claims before they get gazillions of dollars for people who are garbage and shouldn't be on anyone's baseball team.
Well, now the question is, do they have the balls to release him?
I mean, Clevenger, come on. I mean, I'm sure they won't, but come on. This is, I mean, again, there shouldn't even be the implication that maybe talent level would have something to do with it.
Sadly, it does, though.
Yeah, it does, but also, but not enough. I guess I feel like, okay, if it comes down to talent, then why isn't a guy like Clevenger just being cut? Like, come on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Oh. Sadly, the few White Sox fans I follow on Twitter don't seem optimistic about their team cutting ties with him. I'll put it that way. And I don't blame them because the White Sox are not run very well. And as Janice, our White Sox friend, pointed out, Tony La Russa set the precedent here.
Yeah.
If this is the team that is willing to, that was willing to employ him as their manager.
And continue to employ him as their manager for a while.
Yes, for a while. So, and you know, if it wasn't for his failing health, would still be employing him as their manager now. Like, it's not like they fired him. He's not their manager anymore because he's not doing well physically.
And Restore, for whatever his name is, just seems like an asshole himself.
Yeah.
So he's never going to do the right thing.
Yeah, I do not have faith that the White Sox are going to do the right thing, unfortunately. One, like, speaking of doing the right thing, one silver lining is that as of this recording, Trevor Bauer remains unsigned.
There's no wood in this room I can knock on. Come on, man. Ugh.
My desk is wood.
And there haven't even been any rumors.
Keep him out of my sport.
Yeah,
just forever. Like, you're done, man. You're done. And like with Clevenger, if MLB investigates and finds that these accusations are credible and suspends him, because if these accusations are true, which I have no reason to believe they're not based on his past history and the fact that women rarely lie about this, this is also a somewhat unprecedented situation under the domestic violence policy, because this is also abuse of a child.
Yeah.
Baby.
Yeah.
The only other person who has, as far as I know, to my knowledge, I could be wrong, but the only player that I know of that has had any sort of like suspension or like discipline under this policy of stuff involving a child was Felipe Vasquez, who went to jail and is out of baseball forever. It's different because that was sexual abuse. This is not sexual abuse, but this is still abuse of a child. And that is a different level than all of these other players that have been suspended under this policy, even Trevor Bauer. So I think that if MLB investigates, finds these accusations to be credible, there will be, I don't know, like some unprecedented level of discipline here. I think, I hope. Because I think, Lord, like, a lot of this country hates women, And I think we've seen time and time again that baseball doesn't often do right by women. But I think almost everyone agrees on children.
Yeah.
And that that crosses a line even for the worst people who believe that men should be able to do whatever they want to their female intimate partners or their intimate partners, period. I like to hope that people agree that children abusing a baby crosses a line here of some kind. Like if you have any line at all, it has to be that, right?
Yeah, babies should be straightforward.
Yeah, that should be universally condemned, I would think.
And I mean, and I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that something will happen in this case. I think that is a line that is real for most people. I think a lot of times, you know, I worry about what his former partner will, what blame she will bear, because there's always going to be lots of it. But yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but we are going to have ample opportunity to discuss this case, I do believe. But that I am cautiously optimistic that this will, you know, not go well for Clevenger.
Yeah.
Although I see one White Sox person just tweeted, a lot of other women's have come forward about Clevenger on Instagram. This is getting more gross by the second.
Yeah. Like he is, he like we're starting to reach like Bauer levels of trash here. Like he is, yeah. He is trash, like capital T trash. Like this is not a one-off incident sort of thing. This
like is he's a serial offender.
He's a serial abuser.
And it seems like he also went after a lot of like young.
Yeah, there's pretty big differences, the age differences the age, between yeah. him
Which
and
is
his
also
partners.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Not illegal age differences, yeah. mind you. I mean, but big age differences, which is often, you know, when you have these other red flags of like bad power dynamics, like that is just one of many red flags then that come into light. So yeah, this is a really, really bad situation. Like this is not a one-off incident. This is a pattern of behavior, it seems. And yeah, this is gonna go on for a while. Now, whether he will respond in a Trevor Bauer-like fashion and like counter sue everyone remains to be seen. But I think we will be hearing about this for a while. Before we move on to walk-off wins, I did want to at least end this baseball segment on a happy note, which there is a happy note to discuss. We have the first female manager at High A in minor league baseball. I'm going to mispronounce her name, and I feel really bad about it because her last name is difficult to pronounce, and I should have looked it up beforehand, and I apologize. But her first name is Ronnie, and her last name is Gajownik. That's what I'll go with. And I'm very sorry.
Yeah, sounds good.
If that's wrong. I will, if I find like a correct pronunciation somewhere and it's different than what I just said, I will correct myself on a future show. I'm very sorry.
Or tweet us, like all in favor of thoughtful us. Corrections.
Yes, yes, please, please.
Thoughtful corrections.
If you know Ronnie or are Ronnie or know someone who knows her and knows how to pronounce her last name, you can please tweet at us and tell me. I will pronounce it properly on the podcast. But she becomes the first female manager at High A, which is awesome. She's the manager of the Hillsboro Hops, so we love to see that. More and more women, uniformed coaching staff. We love to see it, so that's great. But
wish her a lot of success on the upcoming season.
Yes. Yes. Go Hillsboro Hops. Suddenly yes. A Hillsboro Hops fan.
Big Hillsboro Hops fan.
But we will end the show this week like we always do with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about something that is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Maggie Wiggin, what is your walk-off win for this week? Your inaugural break from hiatus walk-off win.
I mean, it's just this. It's just that I got here. And, you know, and I think I also have to give like a shout out. I don't know if she may be listening. She's on her tablet in her bed under some covers to my daughter, who really wanted this for me, wanted this for me, like independent of me wanting it for me, like, you know, so we made it work. And, you know, and I came to everybody and I was like, can we make this work? And they were like, yeah, we can make this work. So, you know, I guess it's thank you to the my walk-off win is the wonderful women in my life on this show or in her bunk bed across, you know, across the room from me, like for wanting me to be here and wanting me to be a part of this. So thank you guys.
We are so happy that you are here.
Yeah, me too.
And hi, Ellie. Yes. Ellie's always welcome too.
Yeah, she is.
Y'all will probably get to hear her at some point or another, because like I don't think they are all gonna go as smoothly as tonight went.
Yes. But we love having Ellie. Always love having her. Linda Surovich, what is your walk-off win for this week?
It's been a week. So I don't really I got my copy of Spare in.
There you go.
And I've been that's reading. Something. Yeah, it had a lot of holds on it, so I kind of used my librarian privilege, and when our copy came in, I checked it out to myself.
There you go.
So I've been home the past 2 days dealing with other stuff I would rather not be dealing with, but you know, in my downtime, I've been able to read all about the royal drama, which is a nice escape. So, and you know, I've always liked Harry, and he seems to be a lot like his mom, because I always liked Diana as a kid too. So yeah, just reading a good book and escaping from my own personal drama and reading about royal drama has been fun. So it is a good book. I will say it is good. It's worth all the hype that's around it right now. So if you are looking for a biography, I do recommend it. And especially if you like people spilling the tea.
There's no better walk-off win than a good book. Let's be real. It makes seem mundane, but there's nothing like a good book. I had said like that 2022 was, because 2022 was like a crappy year for me in a lot of ways, but like one of the ways in which I like one of the things I regret is that I didn't read a whole lot in 2022. I read some, but like, you know, not at my usual clip, because I was like dealing with so much other crap in my life, and like I wish that I had escaped to books more. And 2023 has already like instantly been a better reading year for me, in the sense that like I'm already reading my fifth book of 2023, and like all the books I've read already have been like bangers. Like it was like 3 bangers in a row that I loved right away, which you don't get that all the time. Like sometimes you go through a rut of reading where you read like a few books in a row, like you don't necessarily hate them, but you're like, I wasn't into that. And every single book I've read so far this year has been like, I've been so into it. And I don't know if it's like just that the books were really good or that my mentality was better. I think it's probably a combination of both. So,
see, I purposely waited because I knew Spare was coming out, so I didn't want to be like in the middle of a book. So I'm like behind on my reading because I've waited so long for this one. So once this one's done, I gotta catch up. Yeah, like, I set my goal for 50 books this year. I'm already way behind.
I'm at 30 and I'm ahead, but I'm purposefully like I'm logging. Like I figure like my strategy this year is I'm gonna log a lot during not baseball season. I'm going to get ahead on my reading so that when I inevitably slow my pace, when I'm spending, you know, 3 hours every evening watching a Mets game, I won't fall behind. Instead, I'll just like fall back to pace.
Yeah.
So that's my goal, but we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. So my walk-off win for this week is actually baseball related. It is that I have, Michael and I have booked our flight and our hotel for San Diego. And so like our new, annual, summer tradition is that we're going to take a baseball trip every summer. Last summer it was Chicago. and this summer it's San Diego. So we are going to see the Mets play at Petco Park against the Padres.
Fun.
Very excited to check Petco Park off the list. Everyone that's been to Petco Park says it's awesome. So I'm really excited. I've been to San Diego before for work, but I've like, you know, I haven't really gotten to do touristy things there. I've only been there for work, like for conferences. So basically I've seen the conference center. I've seen the outside of Petco Park because it's like right by the conference center, but I've never been in it. And I've never like done, I've never gone to San Diego for fun and like gotten to do touristy things. So I'm really excited to actually explore the city. Rather than just like stay at a hotel next to the conference center and go to the conference center. So that's my walk-off one for this week. Very excited to go to San Diego and see the Mets and see Petco Park. It's going to be really fun. So that does it for the show this week. You can go to amazingavenue.com, check out all of our fantastic content. It is prospect list season. So our wonderful folks, on the minors team have dropped, their top 25 Mets prospects or in the process of dropping that, dropping about an article or two a day, I feel like at this rate. So you can check all of that out, check out their analysis of the Mets top prospects, over at amazingavenue.com, along with all of our other daily news posts and other content. Obviously if any, other major Mets happenings occur, we will be covering it. You can follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can follow this show on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Sarafish.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from, your favorite podcast app of choice. Please rate and review the show. It really helps people find it. The original intro and outro to this music is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there's no crying in podcasts.